seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 050303, Thomas Graber and Hopkins and Sutter versus Richard L. Fuqua.
May it please the court, Mr. Ma will present argument to the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue before the court in this case is not only important, but it is a narrow one. And the question is, does federal bankruptcy law preempt a state versus prosecution action or claim that arose from a creditor's filing and prosecuting a dischargeability action in the bankruptcy court? We believe strongly the answer to that question is yes, there is federal preemption of the state prosecution claim under those circumstances, and it was a voluntary bankruptcy that is involved here. We believe the answer is yes, contrary to what the 13th Court, the Corpus Court, found below, based on the really unanimous authority that is out there in other jurisdictions saying there was and is federal preemption of an alternative state remedy, in this case malicious prosecution, for proceedings that are handled in the bankruptcy court. The Ninth Circuit in particular has issued 3 opinions which we have cited, and we furnished the court an updated affirmation of the appellate review panel in the Ninth Circuit in a case called Miles. That's what we furnished 2 days ago. And Miles arose out of an involuntary case, and there are a number of involuntary decisions which, for the most part, overwhelming most part, take the same position as the courts do in the voluntary cases. But in the voluntary cases, like ours, there's a malicious prosecution action filed by a debtor after he has been successful against a creditor's dischargeability claim. Really, as far as we can find, the unanimous voice of the other courts, including the Ninth Circuit I'm talking about, is that there is preclusion because of the federal bankruptcy code.
How far does your argument go? You mentioned at the onset that it's a narrow question, important but narrow, I think you said.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you take the same position that for example, fraud action would be preempted if it concerned conduct that was considered during the bankruptcy proceeding?
Your Honor, I don't think the courts fully flesh that out, but I will use the words of the Ninth Circuit, and there's a lead case I'm going to refer to called MSR in the Ninth Circuit, and it's quoted in all the others, the Sixth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and some others. And they use the term arising out of a bankruptcy proceeding, and it has not been defined a lot further than that. But I would say it's as broad as if there is a bankruptcy proceeding, as there was in this case. Just to set the facts, Mr. Fuqua filed a voluntary bankruptcy. In the course of it, a creditor represented by my clients, petitioners in this case, filed an action to not discharge their debts. They lost. Mr. Fuqua won. He didn't bring any action in the bankruptcy, and obviously that was a bankruptcy proceeding, the dischargeability action. And instead, he waited 2 years, went to state court, filed a malicious prosecution claim. So I would define it as that broad, whether or not it contains elements of fraud. If it is in the bankruptcy court and there is a proceeding, then the federal preemption applies.
So let me put a little finer point on the pencil. If it's intrinsic fraud, you would take the same position, I take it. What if it's extrinsic fraud, something that was, let's assume, not discoverable, but it was fraud and it involved matters that came up during the bankruptcy proceeding? Would you take the same position?
Yeah, I would, Your Honor. I think the courts, by use of the term bankruptcy proceeding, mean if there is the proceeding in bankruptcy because of what Congress did. And I'll return to that in a minute, in establishing this complete, complex, comprehensive code, then there is no, if you will, subject matter jurisdiction or a state court, or for that matter, a federal district court. One of these decisions involved a state malicious prosecution claim brought in the federal district court, and the Ninth Circuit, I believe it was, said no subject matter jurisdiction, whether it's federal or state, once the bankruptcy court has had, I'll use their term, a bankruptcy proceeding. So I say it's narrow. I'm not asking this court to go out beyond and get it even into involuntary cases, although the rules there are the same as here with a few exceptions. And that's where an involuntary petition is filed by a creditor. The court will dismiss it for being not properly brought, allegations of bad faith. And the courts say there, well, that's for a decision by the federal bankruptcy court as to whether the involuntary was sanctionable, not for state courts in malicious prosecution. We're not asking the court to go there. It's just analogous, but it's not the same thing. We're talking about a voluntary filing.
I'm having trouble understanding the rationale for the rule. It seems pretty settled. But as you note, it doesn't seem to be that state courts don't know anything about bankruptcy because you can't even bring the action in a federal court. At least one case says that.
Yes, sir.
You think, well, then is it, your brief refers to the extensive remedies the bankruptcy code affords, but the only sections you cite are 11 U.S. Code 105 and Bankruptcy Rule 9011, and I can't tell what Section 105 means exactly, but 9011 just allows sanctions, which are different, a lot different from damages.
That's correct.
So it seems to me that if this is correct, really there isn't much recourse for malicious prosecution in connection with bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, there's a distinction between voluntary and the involuntary, but on the voluntary point, you're correct. The main remedy, not that there aren't lots of other bankruptcy statutes having something to do with bad faith filing, but the one that gives any remedy really is Federal Bankruptcy Rule 9011. But it does give a meaningful remedy. It gives the attorney's fees that can not just call for payment to the court, it gives the attorney's fees to the aggrieved party, plus it's rather what appears to be a liberal definition of cost incurred as a result of the proceeding.
But it's still different from damages, so you just kind of wonder, why would you shield bankruptcy proceedings from malicious prosecution?
My only answer to that is I don't know, because I'm not Congress and I don't see any indication of why Congress did it. But I think the courts are uniform in saying this was Congress's choice, and they didn't provide special or general damages of just of the nature you're inquiring about in this context. They did allow some damages on the involuntary filing, and I noticed one court said, well, that's because that can do so much damage to the debtor that's thrown in involuntarily and disrupt the business and stop everything. And I don't know why Congress didn't do that on this particular type of filing, but it didn't.
Is there a strict preclusion in the bankruptcy code and rules from, after a determination of the allegedly frivolous action, bringing in the bankruptcy court the malicious prosecution?
Are you saying, is there an express preclusion?
Is there a strict preclusion, code, rules, case law?
In case law, there is.
Let me complete my question. Is there a strict preclusion after the allegedly frivolous action is concluded in the bankruptcy proceeding to bringing to the bankruptcy judge this malicious prosecution claim? Why can't you tell the bankruptcy judge, or maybe you can't, that this was frivolous, it was malicious prosecution, it slandered me, it hurt me in lots of ways, so that it goes beyond just the recovery for the frivolous pleadings and frivolous allegations, rules, and statutes?
I think that's an excellent point, and Mr. Fuqua chose not to do that here. But
I'm asking, can you?
I don't know. Given the reading of these courts as to the exclusivity of what's in there, and if Congress didn't put it in there, you can't get it. You'd just be asking me to speculate whether you could do it. I would be surprised if the court would allow general damages when it doesn't say it in the federal rule or the bankruptcy code in bankruptcy. But the point here, and it is another point as to why the court below was wrong, was Mr. Fuqua chose this forum. He filed the bankruptcy. He's in the bankruptcy. He knows what the rules are, and yet when that dischargeability action finished, he didn't go back to the bankruptcy court and say, I've been aggrieved by malicious filing, I'm entitled to any damages.
But why would he do that if it's post-petition? Bankruptcy deals with pre-petition actions, and this is a post-petition conduct of some nature. Why would he go back there?
Because, Your Honor, it is governed by the bankruptcy code, and that is the place for him to go if he wants relief. I think that is the point of these
reactions. But I thought we just heard you say that there is no specific code provision governing where these post-petition actions have to be brought.
Well, I think, but I thought I gave the answer, and what I intended to say, but didn't, was the preemption doctrine is going to require the debtor to go back to the bankruptcy court, or at least the debtor cannot use a state court tort like malicious prosecution to get an answer. And that's why the person would go back to the bankruptcy court and say, I've been aggrieved under Rule 9011. I want my attorney's fees and all the costs I've incurred as a result of this.
A Sherman Act claim can only be brought in federal court. There doesn't seem to be any indication that if you thought that was maliciously prosecuted, you couldn't bring a state court action to argue that. Or a patent infringement, or even a federal crime, I suppose. I assume that if you refer charges to the U.S. attorney, it turned out they were bogus, and met all the other requirements of the tort, that you could sue in state court for malicious prosecution, even if it was federal crime. I just wonder what's special about bankruptcy.
I think what's special is in those instances, you're not dealing with a code that is as complete to where it's clear that Congress intended, in the language of the courts, to occupy a field or to impliedly preempt any other causes of action arising out of state law. You are dealing with that here. And again, the cases I referred to say that pretty clearly. The MSR, I can find a quote here out of the Miles case in affirming MSR. The language the Miles court used was, this is December of 2005, they have said there can be no state law malicious prosecutions arising out of bank versus filings. Quote, they are completely preempted by the structure and purpose of the bankruptcy code. And I offer that as an answer, Justice Heck, because that's why I said it's a narrow question. I don't think this court can solve all the others. I don't know the ramifications of all the others, except that they are not such a complete comprehensive code. And to go one bit further, Miles agreed with the MSR decision saying there was complete preemption, saying, we agreed that state malicious prosecution actions for events taking place within bankruptcy court proceedings are completely barred. So the other courts, and like I said, there are a few other circuits, and I believe it's Pennsylvania and California and state systems take the same rule, and almost all of them cite the MSR case.
So in your brief, you claim you're successful on preemption, but you distinguish that from subject matter jurisdiction. Bankruptcies can only be brought in bankruptcy court, right? In federal bankruptcy court.
The filing of the petition, yes.
And virtually anything that impacts the debtor's estate after the filing of a bankruptcy gets them subsumed in that bankruptcy or otherwise stayed. Correct? So you have to go to bankruptcy court if you're going to impact the debtor's estate. If a lawsuit like a malicious prosecution claim is going to impact the debtor's estate, why isn't that a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, not just preemption?
I think it would be, but this goes, the federal preemption doctrine, I believe, goes further, because the court is saying no state malicious prosecution action can occur with kind of without regard to what's happened in terms of result in the bankruptcy court if it arises out of a bankruptcy proceeding. So I think in a sense that's broader than what you're saying. And in one sense it may be narrow because there is concurrent jurisdiction with the state courts on a number of things. And both the Corpus Court and the prior decision of the Corpus Court and Mr. Fuqua want to talk about concurrent jurisdiction. What can state courts try that, you know, arise out of a bankruptcy and so forth? We're not arguing that. That's just confusing. We're just saying Congress, as these cases say, pursuant to the grant of power in Article 1, it was empowered to adopt a uniform system. You don't get uniform if you allow all the states to have this kind of remedy arising out of bankruptcy proceedings. So Congress enacts a very comprehensive, complete code which covers the waterfront. And certainly if you invoke that code and you have proceedings in the bankruptcy court, all the cases that have looked at it have said this is federally preempted. If those actions have to take, those requests for relief, as in this case, have to take place in the bankruptcy court.
It's not too difficult to draw a circumstances where a lawsuit is filed sometime after the bankruptcy is concluded, if that's the case, where the facts occurred after the bankruptcy as well, but it impacts the debtor. In this case, the malicious prosecution action was filed, I presume, after the bankruptcy was concluded, but based on conduct during the bankruptcy. Do you think that's not an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, only preemption?
Well, the only thing I would question, because it's not in the record, there's no evidence that the bankruptcy was concluded in this case. So otherwise, I missed what the question was other than that. In general, yes, there can be other state court actions. But if it involves facts arising out of a bankruptcy proceeding in the bankruptcy court, I believe the holdings are clear, which we would urge are persuasive to this court, not binding, that there is federal preemption. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Fuqua will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Dick Fuqua. I am the lawyer in this case. And the plaintiff. I am a bankruptcy lawyer from Houston, Texas. I've practiced before this court on a number of occasions. Began my practice in 1973. Prior to that, I was the law clerk for Judge Arthur Moeller, the bankruptcy judge for the Southern District of Texas. With regard to your question, Judge Johnson, you're right. The bankruptcy code is designed to deal, it takes a Polaroid snapshot of what assets, what liabilities, what rights existed on the day a bankruptcy petition is filed. If you look in the bankruptcy code, that is the wellspring from which all jurisdiction runs in a bankruptcy case. It is exclusive jurisdiction as to the petition. The facts we have here, and I'm going to cite, in our documents, we've noted the court to the Third Circuit.
What does the term arising out of a bankruptcy proceeding mean? What,
Judge,
it's pretty broad.
Well, it's very broad, and the issue, and that's why it is related to jurisdiction. I have a friend at Andrews and Kurth wrote an article once called Core, and there's hard core and soft core, everything's core. Now, that, of course, depends on which bankruptcy judge you're talking to, whether it arises out of the bankruptcy case or not. The answer to your question directly, if it deals with the administration of the estate, in other words, the claims process, if it deals with who gets paid in the distribution schematics, if it deals with what are the assets of the bankruptcy court, state or federal issues, and I'll cite you, if you'll look, to Bankruptcy Rule of Procedure 6009. What it says is the trustee or the debtor can sue in any court or tribunal in the world to affect and protect their rights. It's not, you don't have to bring every lawsuit that you could possibly think of to the bankruptcy court. That's just not the scheme of the law.
But you have to get permission of the bankruptcy court.
Sir, no, sir. Under Bankruptcy Rule of Civil Procedure 6009, a debtor or a trustee may sue at any tribunal with, it doesn't require the permission. What requires the permission is if I'm going to sue the debtor or the estate, I have to go to the bankruptcy judge and seek that judicial officer's permission because that could affect the distribution of my estate.
Help me with that. Does that even have to do with post-petition conduct of the debtor, only pre-petition?
Only pre-petition. Post-petition, and in our moving papers, and I'm going to give you some sites that we've pointed out to you, Bankruptcy Rule 911, according to the United States Supreme Court, is not substantive. It's merely a procedural issue. You did this wrong. You are sanctioned for filing that plea. You signed your name to a pleading inappropriately or without investigating the law to support your plea. It's procedural and it's significant as to that act.
It affords you redress for this kind of thing.
Judge Hecht, no, it does not.
No?
No. And I have to tell you, honestly, the Third Circuit's on point. The Third Circuit in U.S. Express Lines 281 Fed Third, it's a 2002 opinion, says specifically, our review of extant case law persuades us, this is at page 23 of that opinion, sir, persuades us that the federal rules of civil procedure do not preempt claims for abuse of process and similar torts, providing relief for misconduct in federal litigation. Therefore, victims of such misconduct may, in appropriate circumstances, bring suit to recover damages under state causes of action. That's the Third Circuit. The Fifth Circuit, I believe, is in accord with that. In Ray Wood, in Paso del Norte, these are all the cases we cited to the court in our responsive pleadings. The Fifth Circuit says we have federal courts, Article I courts, bankruptcy courts, are given a precise area of law. In fact, the court may recall the old Marathon line of cases from a number of years ago where the Supreme Court declared the bankruptcy code unconstitutional. And then we had to go to a whole process of having Article III judges certify Article I judges who could then take facts and listen to facts and then give the cases to their thoughts to the Article III judge who signed the order.
In the language from that case you read, the U.S. Sorry. Express Lines, there's the condition where appropriate. What does that mean?
If you have, in my opinion, they just say where appropriate. In that instance, you've got a state court cause of action based on conduct that has arisen post-petition in other litigation. That's really where we are right here. We had nobody's gotten to the facts, and so I won't go to the facts, but we had a law firm that prepared documents, knew they were wrong, and acted on them themselves and made a lot of money suing people. But the bottom line is, this conduct occurred post-petition.
What difference does that make?
The property of the estate, Section 541 of the Bankruptcy Code, Judge Hecht, says that remember I told you about a Polaroid snapshot that's taken on the date a bankruptcy case is filed? Property of the estate cannot exceed what was there then.
What difference does it make when the malicious prosecution occurred?
Because if
alleged.
If it pleases the court, if the malicious prosecution had occurred prior to the filing, that's an asset, that's property of the bankruptcy estate. And would be you'd sue in the state court cause of action. Bankruptcy Rule 6009 says you can bring it, prosecute it, proceed.
But pre-petition wouldn't have been in the bankruptcy court anyway. So
pre-petition conduct sometimes gets into the bankruptcy court through litigation.
But we're looking here at stuff that goes on
after.
Surely and
after.
Why is so much case law against you?
Well, if I lived in California, I'd be in a pretty tough spot. But the Third Circuit.
Well, why did you think?
I mean. Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just incidental opinions. I mean, they seem pretty sold on this. I mean,
well. I really don't know any of the justices who've written. I know I do know most of the judges.
I'm not talking psychologically.
Well, but as a matter of law, I think they're wrong. I just think they're wrong. Because they would impliedly say this is preempted. It's not preempted by a statute. There's not a law written. This is one of those deals. And this court has previously written through Senator Cornyn for the court in the Moore v. Brunswick case. A preemption should be very, you don't assume inferred preemptions. It's got to be just an aqua velva moment, a slap in the face. It's got to be obvious.
But you could see that different states took different views of malicious prosecution. It could affect bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, hard to get special damages. And that doesn't happen very often. It happened in this case. With regard to, let me tell you how, cutting to the chase, how I really see it. The Rule 11, and by the way, Section 105 that counsel mentioned is effectively the old all writ statute. It says, you know, a court can enter an order to protect and preserve its jurisdiction. That's the essence of 105. The issue here is really an integrity issue as opposed to a tort issue. Their clients did a tort, intentionally and maliciously. They would say, well, the courts don't give any redress for that. You've got to go talk to Congress. The fabric of law, the bankruptcy code, applies the laws of this state to matters relative to the citizens and causes of action arising in the state. Our common law is applied by the bankruptcy law. All bankruptcy does is create a formalized structure. Is it a fraudulent transfer? Is it a preference? Is this an asset of the estate? Should this be discharged? What are the relative rights under the federal statute, sort of what hangs from the carcass in the freezer? What's there and what's not there? We adopt. The federal courts use the common law of the state of Texas in all respects.
Mr. Fuqua, everything you're talking about is still related to pre-petition conduct, is it not?
That's the essence, yes, sir.
Do they pull in post-petition conduct?
Sir, no, sir. You will find no cases. No cases.
Let's assume that during the pendency of the bankruptcy, the debtor is defrauded out of $1 million. Does the bankruptcy? What happens in the bankruptcy proceeding when that's brought to the
attention of
the bankruptcy
asset, judge? I'm sorry, judge. Was the asset
pre-petition
of
asset
was defrauded?
Pre-petition
asset.
Asset
of the estate. You sue the bankruptcy court.
All right. Let me add this.
Sir,
if the debtor inherits $1 million 2 days after the filing of the petition,
asset
and
of the bankruptcy,
and inherits $1 million 2 days after the petition is filed.
Bankruptcy code says for 6 months, if you inherit.
Okay. Let's say someone gives. It's a post-petition asset. Post-petition asset, $1 million. He gets defrauded out of it.
Oh, it is. And there's a case
in
court.
Can he sue on that in state court?
Yes, sir.
Does he have to come to federal court?
No, sir. Okay. Not at all. In fact, the paramount case on that's the Schreiner case out of Kerrville. Fellow owns a ranch. He's an heir. Gets his trust fund. The trust fund boots in a period of time, so it does not become property of the estate.
Bankruptcy code, in fact, does pull some post-petition assets back into the estate. The inheritance?
Of 6 months.
For example, it does address those matters.
Yes, sir.
Does it address this type tort?
No.
In fact,
that's what I was reading to you about Wood in the Third Circuit. It specifically says those state law causes of action exist. They have vitality. They are not preempted. They're not usurped, and they don't get taken away. This is wrongful conduct done after the filing of bankruptcy. Intentional wrongful conduct.
Don't you think a malicious prosecution suit for what goes on in connection with bankruptcy proceedings is far more likely to affect the way those proceedings are conducted than a malicious prosecution action for a Sherman Act violation or alleged Sherman Act or alleged patent infringement or a federal crime or something else? It seems like there's like a more closed group or something that this is more likely to affect.
I can't imagine a tighter group than patent bar.
Well, yeah.
But that aside, Judge, we have causes. This state, we have causes of action for torts. And I have a footnote that I think will bring my point. Say you had to go to a 341 meeting. Now, that's a meeting conducted under 11 United States Code, Section 341. It says every debtor must attend. Can't get a discharge. You can't proceed forward. In fact, you're in bad trouble if you don't show up. You go to the 341 meeting, and a creditor shows up and pummels you, severely creates harm to you. Fight, beat you up. If you take their theory of the law, that is a cause of action that has no opportunity for redress. It's just not the law. It can't be the law.
On a technical matter, I think the law in the federal courts generally is that you can request sanctions after the proceeding has ended, maybe even for a period of time after. Do you know whether that's true in the bankruptcy court or not?
Bankruptcy Rule of Civil Procedure 9011 adopts Federal Civil Procedure Rule 11. And that's, in fact, the Supreme Court has said that's a sanctions rule for an act, not a course of conduct, not a tort. In fact, that's what the Third Circuit, that I've reviewed, the 10th is in accord with the 3rd. None of them are in accord with the 9th. Or said conversely, the 9th, the 3rd, and the 10th, and I think the 5th, are not in accord with the 9th.
During the bankruptcy proceeding and after the action that you contend there was a lack of probable cause for concluded, could you have brought your malicious prosecution arguments, assertions, or claim to the attention of the bankruptcy judge?
You could have brought it to their attention, but they had no jurisdiction to entertain it. 1334, 28.
Didn't that malicious prosecution, or, as you claim, affect your estate? It took money out of your estate having to defend it, didn't it?
No, actually it didn't. And let me tell you why.
Your lawyers were free?
Oh, no, I had to pay a lot. But when you file, I built the Embassy Suites in McAllen, which is what caused the filing. The banks went broke. We lost our financing. I had a 90-day note instead of an 18-year note. Bottom line, what occurs is all my assets, I empty my pockets on the day I file bankruptcy. Every asset I have goes to my trustee for administration. I had to pay out of my post-petition earnings as a lawyer all those 4 years. I didn't invade the bankruptcy estate at all. There was no chance it was going to be increased or decreased by virtue of their conduct.
But you could have moved for sanctions
under 9/11
at the conclusion of the adversary proceeding.
I think I could have gotten a sanction. Well, I'm not sure to be.
We could have moved.
You could. Well, that's why, Judge.
And maybe even for some time after that.
I do not know. Well, no. To be candid, I'm not sure. I think you will note from the briefing, this cause of action didn't arise for a number of years after I prevailed because they appealed. They being the Hopkins and Sutter and Graber. So the bankruptcy court, I guess for that 30 days, could probably have entertained 9/11 sanctions, but they would have lost jurisdiction of the case totally upon the filing of the appeal because that whole case would then go up to the district. And under the federal schematic, from the district would then go to the Fifth Circuit. And I chose not to waive my state law causes of action.
Is there a requirement that you make an election on your state law cause of action?
No,
why
sir.
Did you say you chose not to waive?
I didn't want to risk competent counsel appearing and saying, well, that was your one shot. 9/11, that covers everything. And it doesn't.
So that's the reason?
Yes, sir.
You didn't make a motion for sanctions because you were concerned about waiver?
Yes, sir.
Okay. One element of a malicious prosecution action is to show lack of probable cause for
yes,
proceeding.
Sir.
And I suppose that would ordinarily, or in many cases, require an expiration of the substantive bankruptcy law.
In this,
whether there was probable cause or not, you'd have to know what the law was.
Well, right. But it's even worse than that, Judge Hatfield. The problem here, they filed the cause of action and didn't distribute any of the documents for years. Years. Not just a few. I mean, if you want a timeline, the case was filed December 31, 1988. The trial of the 523 cause of action goes forward May 13 of 1997 through Mr. Graber's assistance or relationship with the United States Attorney's Office in Dallas. That there was an intervention by all those people in the trial of the case I was trying to go. What caused this is I was about to depose their witnesses. I'd already been deposed. And they said, oh, no, this could harm an ongoing investigation. Please stay it. So I didn't see the documents that they really alleged their claim was based in until maybe 97. And the truth of the fact, the law firm that prepared the takedown documents for the FDIC, creating the new savings loan and assigning other assets to the FDIC corporate, is the same law firm. They knew they didn't assign that cause of action against me to the new law, to the new savings and loan, who filed the objection to dischargeability of debt. It was assigned to FDIC corporate, a different legal entity, as they point out in many cases they have. So I couldn't even have found out until after these trials.
How broad is the rule you're arguing for? What types of cases can you not bring after a bankruptcy proceeding is concluded that relates to conduct, admittedly, that occurred during the bankruptcy? You can bring fraud claims, I assume you would say.
I think the entire scheme of common law. In fact, there's a site. I don't think I cited it because I came across it as dicta. 112 Bankruptcy Reports 197. It's from Judge Letitia Clark in the Southern District of Texas. And she sort of points out that causes of action for things that happen after the bankruptcy petition's filed are new. It's like a divining, an absolute bright white line, Judge. Everything before is dealt with in the bankruptcy estate. Everything after is not in the bankruptcy estate.
With some exceptions, like the inheritance
well,
you mentioned.
But that's in the statute, though.
Right. But it's still not a snapshot at
right.
the time of filing.
Well, but whatever right you had was in the snapshot, it's just they materialized somewhat later. They vested later. In other words, you had the right. The will was already written. You just inherited later.
What else does Judge Clark say that you were going to point out?
It was a case, Saxenian. The name of the case is Moran v. Saxenian. And what she says is, what happened is a judgment was entered pre-bankruptcy, a discharge entered, a garnishment action filed, and Humble Oil refused to pay the debtor money he'd earned post-petition because they said, well, there was a garnishment out there. In the very last sentence, Judge Clark says, I find that the conduct, the debt's discharged, nobody's pressing the garnishment. This is just Exxon being careful and conservative. However, if this conduct continues, the debtor has his state court law rights to proceed. In other words, post-petition, harm, go to the state court. Not a bankruptcy court.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Police court. I don't believe in that entire argument I heard the word preemption. I don't think I heard it. And the reason is either Mr. Fuqua nor the Corpus Court have any authority to support them on the point, the narrow point we're here on today, which is, I submit, Congress preempted state law court actions for malicious prosecution. Don't take it any broader than that. Arising out of proceedings in the bankruptcy court. Yes, they're post-petition. but the opinions are so clear. I didn't hear any discussion about not just the need, but the requirement under Article 1 for uniformity in the bankruptcy decision and how you reconcile that with 50 different state explanations of what is a malicious prosecution, abuse of process, do you have bad faith, are you grossly negligent, is it intentional? I didn't hear any discussion of that. And the cases say that's a really important criteria that Congress had in mind. That's what empowered it to establish a uniform system, quote, among all the states.
Mr. Fuqua says that the 10th, 3rd, and 5th Circuit are not in accord with the 9th Circuit.
I'm not sure which 5th Circuit case he's talking about. That is not true, in my view, as to the 3rd Circuit. That case involved a question of whether the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure created a preemption, and we're not arguing that. That's not this case. It didn't involve a proceeding. I believe that involved a maritime case, and it didn't involve a proceeding that took place in bankruptcy.
And one Fifth Circuit case he cited was in Ray Wood. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm not.
We'll both read it then.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you. And finally, all of the cases, including the Pennsylvania U.S. District Court case, which adopted this view, say that Congress chose the remedies. While none of us may like them, they chose the remedy. 9011 is the principal remedy. Mr. Fuqua filed voluntarily. He chose not to use that remedy. We submit the law is clear. We urge this court to put Texas in line with the majority cases, hold that there is preemption under the Bankruptcy Act for state law cause of action like malicious prosecution arising out of conduct or filings in a bankruptcy proceeding. Thank you very much for your time.
Excuse me, before you go, I have one question. Counsel David, hypothetical, at least to me, he would say he's a debtor and a creditor, meaning he's beat up by a creditor. Is it preempted or not?
I guess I'd have to know more about the context of that proceeding. If it's a hearing and he's in a hearing and he's engaged in that, then I would say that would probably come under the definition of preemption as applied by these courts. Again, that's not the question here, and that's why I have said I think the issue before the court is narrow, and you can make it broader, but who knows where that goes. I think it's clear on the point and issue. Thank you.
Thank you. The cause is submitted. All causes are submitted this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.